Of course, hard to say what they meant, but if England came to help now, would it not be possible that this soil would once again be English soil?
He had borrowed glasses from Sorel, was looking at the Union lines. He could see cannon now, rolled out in front of the trees. He could see men moving among the caissons, men on horseback moving in the trees. Here and there a pennant blew. He saw a flash of gold. Breastworks were going up, twisted sticks, small, very far away. There was an open valley below him, partly cultivated, then a long, bare rise to the Union line. To the left was the high hill, Cemetery Hill, that Ewell had failed to take the day before, the hill that had worried Longstreet. To the center was a wooded ridge. To the right there were two round hills, one rocky, the other wooded. The Union position was approximately 3 miles in length, or so it seemed from here. All this Fremantle saw with continually rising excitement. He looked down, saw Longstreet rise, move off, shoulders bowed, wandering head down and lumbering like a bearded stump to stare out at the lines. Hood joined him. Once more Longstreet shook his head. Lee came back to a small table, stared at a map, looked up, back toward the Union lines, keeping his hand on the map. Fremantle had a good look at that extraordinary face. Lee looked weary, more pale than before. The sun was climbing. It was noticeably hotter. Fremantle felt a familiar rumble in his own stomach. Oh, God, not the soldier's disease. Those damned cherries. There seemed no point in remaining in the tree. Soldiers had observed him, hanging in the air like a plump gray fruit. Were beginning to point and grin. Fremantle descended with dignity, joined the other foreigners. He heard for the first time that day music. A polka. He listened with surprise. He could not identify the sound, but he knew the beat. It was followed by a march. Ross said, "They play even during an attack. Not very good, but inspiring. Have you heard the rebel yell?" Fremantle nodded.
"God-awful sound. I expect they learned it from the Indians."
Ross opened wide his eyes.
"Never thought of that," he said.
His silver helmet shifted. Sweat was all over his brow.
"I say, old friend, you really aren't going to wear that thing all day, are you? In this charming climate?"
"Well," Ross said. He tweaked his mustache. "One must be properly dressed. Teach these fellows respect."
Fremantle nodded. "Understandable. One tried to be neat. But that helmet." And Ross did tend to look a bit ridiculous, like some sort of fat-plumed duck. These chaps all look so natural, so earthy. Not the officers, but the troops. Hardly any uniform at all. Brown and yellow. Americans. Odd. So near, yet so far. He saw Moxley Sorrell walking briskly off on a mission. Corralled him, as the Americans would put it. Sorrell said, "We've sent our engineers to inspect the ground to our right. We'll be attacking later in the day. Don't know where yet, so you can relax, I should say, for 2 hours or so at least."
"Have you heard from General Stuart?"
"Not a word. General Lee has sent out scouts to find him."
Sorrell chuckled.
"Cheer up. You may have your charge."
"I hope to have a good position today."
"We'll do all we can. I suggest you stay close to Longstreet. There'll be action where he is."
Sorrell moved off. Through the trees, Fremantle saw Longstreet mounting his horse. Fremantle led his own horse that way. Longstreet had Gorey with him, the aide from Texas. The greeting was friendly, even warm. Fremantle thought, startled. "He likes me," and flushed with unexpected pride. He asked if he could ride with the general. Longstreet nodded. They rode down to the right, along the spine of the ridge, in under the trees. Most of Longstreet's staff had joined them. Longstreet said to Hood, "I'll do what I can. His mind seems set on it." Hood shrugged. He seemed smaller now when you were close. He had extraordinary eyes. The eyebrows were shaggy and tilted, and the eyes were dark as coal, so that he seemed very sad. Freemetal had a sudden numbing thought. By evening, this man could be dead. Freemantle stared at him, transfixed, trying to sense a premonition. He had never had a premonition, but he had heard of them happening, particularly on the battlefield. Men often knew when their time had come. He stared at Hood, but truthfully, except for the sadness in the eyes, which may have been only weariness, for Hood had marched all night, there was no extra sensation. Nothing at all but a certain delicious air of impending combat, which was with them all, Longstreet most of all, sitting round and immobile on the black horse, gazing eastward. Hood said, "Well, if he's right, then the war is over by sundown." Longstreet nodded. "We'll see. But going in without picket is like going in with one boot off. I'll wait as long as I can." Hood cocked his head toward the Union lines. "Do you have any idea of the force?" Longstreet ticked off the corps so far identified, 5, counting the 2 involved in the first day's action. He thought there would be more very soon, that perhaps even now the entire army was up. Lee did not think so. But yesterday he had not thought the Yankees would be there at all, and they were there in force. And now today the Yankees were on the high ground. And with Stuart gone, there was no way of knowing just how many corps lay in wait beyond the haze of that far ridge. Freemantle rode along politely, silently, listening. He had developed a confidence that was almost absolute. He knew that Longstreet was tense and that there was a certain gloom in the set of his face, but Freemantle knew with the certainty of youth and faith that he could not possibly lose this day, not with these troops, not with Englishmen, the gentlemen against the rabble. He rode along with delight blossoming in him like a roseate flower, listening. Longstreet looked at him vacantly, saw him, then looked at him.
"Colonel," he said abruptly, "how are you?"
"By George, sir, I am fine, I must say."
"You slept well?"
Freemantle thought. "Everyone seems concerned that I sleep well."
"Oh, very well," he paused. "Not long, mind you, but well."
Longstreet smiled. There seemed to be something about Freemantle that amused him. Freemantle was oddly flattered. He did not know why.
"I would like some day to meet the Queen," Longstreet said.
"I'm sure that could be arranged. Sir, you would be considered most welcome in my country, a most distinguished visitor."
There was firing below, a sharp popping, a scattering of shots, a bunch, another bunch. Then silence. Longstreet put on his glasses, looked down into the valley.
"Pickets," he said.
Freemantle, who did not know what to expect, started, gulped, stared. But he was delighted. He saw puffs of white smoke start up down in the valley, like vents in the earth, blow slowly, lazily to his left, to the north. He looked up at the ridge, but he could see only a few black cannon, a single flag. He said abruptly,
"I say, sir, you say you won't be attacking for a bit?"
Longstreet shook his head.
"Then, if I may be so bold, what's to prevent the Yankees from attacking you?"
Longstreet looked at Hood.
"I mean, I don't see that you bothered to entrench,"
Freemantle went on. Longstreet grinned. Hood grinned.
"An interesting thought," Longstreet smiled. "I confess, it had not occurred to me."
"Me neither," Hood said.
"But I suppose it's possible," Longstreet said.
"You really think so?"
"Well," Longstreet hedged.
He grinned, reached up along the edge of his hat, scratched his head.
I guess not.
More soberly, he turned to Fremantle.
It would be most unlike General Meade to attack. For one thing, he is General Meade. For another, he has just arrived on the field, and it will take him some time to understand the position. Like perhaps a week. Also, he has not yet managed to gather the entire army of the Potomac, all 200,000 men, and he will be reluctant to move without his full force. Then again, he will think of reasons.
Longstreet shook his head, and Fremantle saw that he had again lost his humor.
No, Meade will not do us the favor, the great favor. We will have to make him attack. We will have to occupy dangerous ground between him and Washington and let the politicians push him to the assault, which they will most certainly do, given time. We need time.
He paused, shook his head. They rode on in silence. Fremantle began to realize how remarkably still it was. Down in the valley, the fields were open and still. The breeze had slowed. There was no movement of smoke. A few cows grazed in the shade, rested in dark pools of shade under the trees. Fremantle could feel the presence of that vast army. He knew it was there. Thousands of men, thousands of horses, miles of cannon, miles of steel. And spread out beyond him and around him Lee's whole army in the dark shade, moving, settling, lining up for the assault. And yet from this point on the ridge under the tree, he could look out across the whole valley and see nothing, hear nothing, feel nothing, not even a trembling of the earth, not even one small, slow rumble of all those feet and wheels moving against the earth, moving in together like two waves meeting in a great ocean, like two avalanches coming down together on facing sides of a green mountain. The day had dawned clear, but now there were clouds beginning to patch the sky with hazy blots of cottony white, and not even any motion there, just the white silence against the blue. It was beginning to be very hot, hotter even than before, and Fremantle noticed perspiration on all the faces. He had not slept well, and suddenly the silence and the heat began to get to him. He was a man from a northern clime, and England did not have this sort of weather. And when you have not slept... He was most anxious to move on with Longstreet, but he saw Lawley and Ross pull off into an open field and sit down, and so he bade Longstreet goodbye and rode off to join his fellow Europeans. He let his horse roam with the others in a fenced field, and found himself a grassy place under a charming tree, and lay flat on his back, gazing up serenely into the blue, watching those curious flecks that you can see if you stare upward against the vacant blue, the defects of your own eye. They chatted, telling stories of other wars. They discussed the strategy of Napoleon, the theories of Jomini, the women of Richmond. Fremantle was not that impressed by Napoleon, but he was impressed by the women of Richmond. He lay dreamily, remembering certain ladies, a ball, a rose garden. This land was huge. England had a sense of compactness, like a garden, a lovely garden. But this country was without borders. There was this refreshing sense of space, of blowing winds, too hot, too cold, too huge. Raw, in a way raw meat is raw. And yet there were the neat farms, the green country, so much like home. The people so much like home. Southern home.
Couldn't grow flowers, these people. No gardens. Great weakness.
And yet, they are Englishmen. Should I tell Longstreet? Would it annoy him?
He thinks, after all, that he is an American.
The great experiment in democracy. The equality of rabble. In not much more than a generation, they have come back to class, as the French have done. What a tragic thing, that revolution. Bloody George was a bloody fool. But no matter. The experiment doesn't work. Give them 50 years, and all that equality rot is gone. Here they have that same love of the land, and of tradition, of the right form, of breeding, in their horses, their women. Of course, slavery is a bit embarrassing, but that, of course, will go. But the point is they do it all exactly as we do in Europe, and the North does not. That's what the war is really about. The North has those huge bloody cities and 1,000 religions, and the only aristocracy is the aristocracy of wealth. The Northerner doesn't give a damn for tradition, or breeding, or the old country. He hates the old country. Odd. You very rarely hear a Southerner refer to the old country. In that pained way a German does, or an Italian. Well, of course, the South is the old country. They haven't left Europe. They've merely transplanted it. And that's what the war is about. Fremantle opened an eye. It occurred to him that he might have come across something rather profound, something to take back to England. The more he thought about it, the more clear it seemed. In the South, there was one religion, as in England, one way of life. They even allowed the occasional Jew, like Longstreet's Major Moses, or Judah Benjamin back in Richmond. But by and large, they were all the same nationality, same religion, same customs. A little rougher, perhaps, but my word. Fremantle sat up. Major Clark was resting back against a tree. Fremantle said, "I say, Major, Longstreet is an English name, I should imagine." Clark blinked. "No, as a matter of fact, I don't think it is." He pondered. "Dutch, I think." "Yes, come to think of it, Dutch, all right. Comes from New Jersey. The old Dutch settlements up there?" "Oh."
Fremantle's theory had taken a jolt.
Well, but Longstreet was an exception. He was not a Virginian.
Fremantle again relaxed. He even began to feel hungry. The morning moved toward noon. 2. Chamberlain. The regiment sat in an open field studded with boulders like half-sunken balls. Small fires burned under a steam-gray sky. Chamberlain wandered, watching, listening. He did not talk. He moved silently among them, hands clasped behind his back, wandering, nodding, soaking in the sounds of voices, tabulating the light in men's eyes, moving like a forester through a treasured grove, noting the condition of the trees. All his life he had been a detached man, but he was not detached anymore. He had grown up in the cold New England woods, the iron dark, grown in contained silence like a lone house on a mountain. And now he was no longer alone. He had joined not only the army, but the race, not only the country, but mankind. His mother had wanted him to join the church. Now he had his call. He wandered. Sensing. Tired men, but ready. Please, God, do not withdraw them now. He saw illness in one face, told the man to report to sick call. One man complained.
"Colonel, it keeps raining. These damn Enfield's gonna clog on us. Why don't we trade him for Springfield's, first chance we get?"
Chamberlain agreed. He saw Buckland, together with a cold-eyed group from the old Second Maine, nodded good morning, did not stop to talk. A young private asked him,
Sir, is it true that General McClellan is in command again?
Chamberlain had to say no. The private swore. Chamberlain finished the walk, went back alone to sit under a tree. He had dreamed of her in the night, dreamed of his wife in a scarlet robe, turning witch-like to love him. Now, when he closed his eyes, she was suddenly there, hot candy presence. Away from her, you loved her more. The only need was her, she the only vacancy in the steamy morning. He remembered her letter, the misspelled words. I lie here dreamily. Even the misspelling is lovely. A mass of men was coming down the road, unarmed, unspiked, no rifles visible. Prisoners. They stopped near a long rock ledge which walled the road. Some of his own troops began drifting over that way to stare, to chat. They were usually polite to prisoners. The accents fascinated them. Although some of the regiment were sailing men, most of them had never been out of Maine. Chamberlain thought vaguely of the South. She had loved it. She had been at home. Heat and Spanish moss. Strange hot land of courtly manners and sudden violence. Elegance and anger. A curious mixture. The white-columned houses high on the green hills, the shacks down in the dark valleys. Land of black and white. No gray. The South was a well-bred, well-mannered, highly educated man challenging you to a duel. She loved it. Dreamily. She had liked being a professor's wife. She had been outraged when he went off to war. Square-headed Kilrain.
Is the colonel awake?
Chamberlain nodded, looking up.
Oh, you found me a John Henry, sir.
John who?
A John Henry, sir. A black man. A darky. He's over that way.
Kilrain gestured. Chamberlain started to rise.
I heard him a-groanin', Kilrain said, just before dawn. Would the colonel care to see him?
Lead on. Kilrain walked down a grassy slope away from the road, across the soft field marshy with heavy rain, up a rise of granite to a gathering of boulders along the edge of a grove of dark trees. Chamberlain saw two men standing on a rock ledge, men of the regiment. Kilrain sprang lightly up the rock. The two men, one was the newcomer Bucklin, touched their caps and wished him, "Mornin'," and grinned and pointed. The black man lay in the shadow between two round rocks. He was very big and very black. His head was shaved and round and resting on mossy granite. He was breathing slowly and deeply, audibly. His eyes were blinking. He wore a faded red shirt, ragged, dusty, and dark pants ragged around his legs. There were no sleeves in the shirt, and his arms had muscles like black cannonballs. His right arm was cupped across his belly. Chamberlain saw a dark stain, a tear, realized that the man had been bleeding. Bucklin was bending over him with a tin cup of coffee in his hand. The black man took a drink. He opened his eyes, and the whites of his eyes were red-stained and ugly. Chamberlain pointed to the wound. How bad is that?
Oh, not bad, Kilrain said. I think he's bled a lot, but, you know, you can't really tell.
Bucklin chuckled. That's a fact.
Bullet wound, Kilrain said. Just under the ribs.
Chamberlain knelt. The black man's face was empty, inscrutable. The red eyes looked up out of a vast darkness. Then the man blinked, and Chamberlain realized that there was nothing inscrutable here. The man was exhausted. Chamberlain had rarely seen black men. He was fascinated. We'll get him something to eat. Then we'll get him to a surgeon. Is the bullet still in?
Don't know. Don't think so. Haven't really looked.
Kilrain paused.
He sure is black, and that's a fact.
Did you get his name?
He said something I couldn't understand. Hell, Colonel. I can't even understand them Johnnies. You know, I've been a long time in this army.
The black man drank more of the coffee, put out both hands and took the cup, drank, nodded, said something incomprehensible.
Guess he was a servant on the march. Took a chance to run away. Guess they shot at him.
Chamberlain looked at the bald head, the ragged dress. Impossible to tell the age. A young man, at least. No lines around the eyes. Thick-lipped. Huge jaw. Look of animal strength. Chamberlain shook his head. He wouldn't be a house servant. Look at his hands. Field hands. Chamberlain tried to communicate. The man said something, weakly, softly. Chamberlain, who could speak 7 languages, recognized nothing. The man said a word that sounded like Batu, Batu, and closed his eyes.
God, Kilrain said. He can't even speak English.
Buckland grunted. Maybe he's just bad wounded. Chamberlain shook his head. No, I think you're right. I don't think he knows the language. The man opened his eyes again, looked directly at Chamberlain, nodded his head, grimaced, said again, Batu, Batu. Chamberlain said, Do you suppose that could be thank you? The black man nodded strongly. Tangu, Tangu Baz. That's it. Chamberlain reached out, patted the man happily on the arm. Don't worry, fella. You'll be all right. He gestured to Kilrain. Here, let's get him up. They carried the man down out of the rocks, lay him on open grass. A knot of soldiers gathered. The man pulled himself desperately up on one elbow, looked round in fear. Kilrain brought some hardtack and bacon, and he ate with obvious hunger. But his teeth were bad. He had trouble chewing the hardtack. The soldiers squatted around him curiously. You saw very few black men in New England. Chamberlain knew one to speak to. A silent, round-headed man with a white wife. A farmer living far out of town without friends. You saw black men in the cities, but they kept to themselves. Chamberlain's curiosity was natural and friendly, but there was a reserve in it, an unexpected caution. The man was really very black. Chamberlain felt an oddness, a crawly hesitation, not wanting to touch him. He shook his head, amazed at himself. He saw, palm of the hand almost white, blood dries normally, skin seems dusty. But he could not tell whether it was truly dust or only a natural sheen of light on hair above black skin. But he felt it again, a flutter of unmistakable revulsion. Fat lips, brute jaw, red-veined eyeballs. Chamberlain stood up. He had not expected this feeling. He had not even known this feeling was there. He remembered suddenly a conversation with a southerner a long time ago, before the war, a Baptist minister. White, complacent face, sense of bland, enormous superiority. My dear man, you have to live among them. You simply don't understand. Kilrain said, And this is what it's all about. A soldier said softly. Poor bastard. Hey, Sarge, how much you figure he's worth, this one, on the hoof? Funny, very funny. But they'd give $1,000 for him, I bet. 900 for sure. Really? Hell. It was Buckland, grinning. Why don't we sell him back and buy out in this army? Chamberlain said to Kilrain, He can't have been long in this country. No. A recent import, you might say. I wonder how much he knows of what's happening. Kilrain shrugged. A crowd was gathering. Chamberlain said, Get a surgeon to look at that wound. He backed off. He stared at the palm of his own hand. A matter of thin skin. A matter of color. The reaction is instinctive. Any alien thing. And yet Chamberlain was ashamed. He had not known it was there. He thought, if I feel this way, even I, an educated man, what was in God's mind? He remembered the minister. And what if it is you who are wrong, after all? Tom came bubbling up with a message from Vincent. The Corps would move soon, on further orders. Tom was chuckling.
Lawrence, you want to hear a funny thing? We were talking to these three Reb prisoners, trying to be sociable, you know? But mainly trying to figure them out. They were farm-type fellas. We asked them why they were fighting this war. Thinking on slavery and all, and one fella said they was fighting for their rats.
Hee! That's what he said.
Tom giggled, grinned. We all thought they was crazy. But we hadn't heard aright. They kept on insisting they wasn't fighting for no slaves, they were fighting for their rats. It finally dawned on me that what the fella meant was their rights. Only the way they talk, it came out rats.
Hee!
Then after that, I asked this fellow what rights he had that we were offending. And he said, well, he didn't know, but he must have some rights he didn't know nothing about. Now, ain't that something?
Button your shirt, Chamberlain said.
Yes, sir, boss.
Hey, what we got here? He moved to see the surrounded black. The surgeon had bent over the man, and the red eyes had gone wild with new fear, rolling horse-like, terrified. Chamberlain went away, went back to the coffee pot. He felt a slow, deep flow of sympathy. To be alien and alone, among white lords and glittering machines, uprooted by brute force and threat of death from the familiar earth of what he did not even know was Africa. To be shipped in black, stinking darkness across an ocean he had not dreamed existed. Forced then to work on alien soil, strange beyond belief, by men with guns whose words he could not even comprehend. What could the black man know of what was happening? Chamberlain tried to imagine it. He had seen ignorance, but this was more than that. What could this man know of borders and states' rights and the Constitution and Dred Scott? What did he know of the war? And yet he was truly what it was all about. It simplified to that. Seen in the flesh, the cause of the war was brutally clear. He thought of writing Fanny a quick letter. Dreamy Lee. He wanted to tell her about the black man. He wanted time to think. But the 83rd Pennsylvania was up and forming. Ellis Spear was coming along the line. It came to Chamberlain suddenly that they might move from here to battle, under his command. He took a deep breath. Bloody, lonely feeling. He moved back to the cluster around the black man. The shirt was off, and Nolan was attending him. The light was stronger. The sun was a blood-red ball just over the hills. Chamberlain saw a glistening black chest, massive muscles. The black man was in pain. Nolan said, "He'll be all right, Colonel. Bullet glanced off a rib. Cut the skin. Looks just like anybody else inside." Nolan clucked in surprise. "Never treated a Negro before. This one's a tough one. They all got muscles like this one, Colonel?" "We'll have to leave him," Chamberlain said. "Let him have some rations. Try to give him directions. Buster, can you talk to him?"
"A little. Found out who shot him. It was some woman in that town there. Gettysburg."
"A woman?"
"He came into town looking for directions, and a woman came out on a porch and shot at him. He don't understand. I guess she didn't want to take a chance on being caught with him. But shoot him? Christ! He crawled out here figuring on dying."
Chamberlain shook his head slowly.
Kilrain said, "He's only been in this country a few weeks. He says he'd like to go home, since now he's free."
Bugles were blowing. The men were moving out into formation. Tom came up with the black mare.
I don't know what I can do, Chamberlain said. Give him some food, bind him up, make a good bandage. But I don't know what else.
Which way is home, Colonel?
Let's go, Buster.
Do I point him generally east?
Chamberlain shrugged. He started to move off, and then he turned, and to the black face looking up, to the red eyes, he looked down and bowed slightly, touching his cap. Goodbye, friend. Good luck. God bless you. He rode off, feeling foolish and angry, placed himself in front of the regiment. The division was forming on level ground, down the road, great square blocks of blue. The colors were unfurled, the lines were dressed. A stillness came over the corps. They were expecting a review, possibly Meade himself. But no one came. Chamberlain sat on his horse, alone in the sun before the ranks of the 20th Maine. He heard Tozia behind him. Dress it up! Dress it up! A muffled complaint. Whispers. The far sound of hoofs pawing the ground. His own horse stood quietly, neck down, nibbling Pennsylvania grass. Chamberlain let the mare feed. The day was very hot. He saw a buzzard floating along in the pale blue above, drifting and floating. And he thought of the smell of dead men and chicken hawks swooping down, and the only eagle he'd ever seen, in captivity, back in Brewer. A vast wingspread. A murderous eye. Colonel Vincent came down the line, trailing aides like blue clouds. Chamberlain saluted. Vincent looked very happy. We'll be moving up soon. No action this morning. I expect we'll be in reserve.
Yes, sir.
Reserve is the best duty. That means they'll use us where we're needed. Once more into the breach, he grinned brightly, showing teeth almost womanly white. How does that go, Professor? Chamberlain smiled politely. You spell breach with an A, am I right?
Thought so. I'm a Harvard man myself.
Vincent grinned, looked thoughtfully at the regiment. Glad you got those extra men. You may need 'em. How are they getting along? Fine. Vincent nodded, reached out cheerily, patted Chamberlain on the arm. You'll be all right, Colonel. Glad to have you with us.
I'm having some beef driven up. If there's time, we'll have a good feed tonight in this brigade.
He was interrupted by bugles, and there it was. Dan, 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 Butterfield, Butterfield. He swung his horse to listen, saw riders approaching, began to move that way. Over his shoulder he said, Anything you need, Colonel, and he rode off. The call came to advance. Chamberlain turned to face the regiment. He ordered right shoulder arms. The rifles went up. He drew his sword, turned. Down the line the order came. Advance! He gave the long order to Tozia. Guide on the next regiment, the 118th Pennsylvania. He raised his sword. They began to move, the whole corps in mass, at slow march forward through a flat farm, a peach orchard. He ordered root step. Looking far off down the line, he saw the men moving in a long blue wave, the heart-stopping sight of thousands of men walking silently forward, rifles shouldered and gleaming in the sun. Colors bobbing. The officers in front on high-stepping horses. Chamberlain sucked in his breath. Marvelous. Marvelous. Behind him he could hear men joking, but he could not hear the jokes. Details of men in front were removing white rail fences. He rode past a house, slowed to let the men flow round it, saw a fat woman in a bonnet, a gray dress, standing on the porch, her hands in her apron. She extracted one hand, waved slowly, silently. Chamberlain bowed. Some of the men wished her good morning. A sergeant apologized for marching through her farm. The regiment moved on across the open place and through a cornfield and some low bushes. Then there was high ground to the right. The front of the corps swung to face south, rolled forward down a slope through more cornfields. The corn was high, and the men tried not to trample it, but that was not possible.
It was becoming a long walk, up and down in the heat. But Chamberlain was not tired. They came to a brook, cold water already very dirty from many men moving upstream. Chamberlain sent back word that no one was to fall out to fill a canteen. Canteen bearers would be appointed. On the far side of the brook, they came upon a broad road in the rear of the army. He saw a long line of dark wagons, a band of provost guards, men gathered in groups around stacked rifles, small fires. To the right, there was an artillery park, dozens of guns and caissons and horses. Beyond that road, there was a rise of ground. And at that moment, looking upward toward a broad tree on a knoll just above, a tree with huge branches spread wide in the shape of a cup, full and green against a blue sky, Chamberlain heard the first gun, a cannon, a long, soft boom of a gun firing a long way off. A short while later, the corps was stopped. They were told to stop where they were and rest. The men sat in a flat field, an orchard to the left, trees and men everywhere, higher ground in front of them. They waited. Nothing happened. There was the sound of an occasional cannon, but even the crows nearby were silent. Some of the men began to lie back, to rest. Chamberlain rode briefly off to find out what would happen, but no one knew. When he returned, he found himself a place under a tree. It was very hot. He had just closed his eyes when a courier arrived with a message from Meade to read to the troops. Chamberlain gathered them around him in the field, in the sunlight, and read the order. Hour of decision, enemy on soil. When he came to the part about men who failed to do their duty being punished by instant death, it embarrassed him. The men looked up at him with empty faces. Chamberlain read the order and added nothing, went off by himself to sit down. Damn fool order. Mind of West Point at work. No time to threaten a man. Not now. Men cannot be threatened into the kind of fight they will have to put up to win. They will have to be led. By you, Joshua, by you. Well, let's get on with it. He looked out across the field. The men were sleeping, writing letters. Some of them had staked their rifles bayonet first into the ground and rigged tent cloth across to shade them from the sun. One man had built a small fire and was popping corn. No one was singing. Kilrain came and sat with him, took off his cap, wiped a sweating red face. John Henry's still with us. He indicated the woods to the east. Chamberlain looked, did not see the dark head. We ought to offer him a rifle, Kilrain said. There was a silence. Chamberlain said, Don't know what to do for him. Don't think there's anything we can do. Don't guess he'll ever get home. Guess not. Suppose he'll wander to a city. Pittsburgh. Maybe New York. Fella can always get lost in a city. A cannon thumped far off. A soldier came in from foraging, held a white chicken aloft, grinning. Kilrain said, God damn all gentlemen. Chamberlain looked. Square head, white hair, a battered face, scarred around the eyes like an old fighter. In battle he moved with a crouch, a fanged white ape, grinning. Chamberlain had come to depend on him. In battle men often seemed to melt away, reappearing afterward with tight, mirthless grins. But Kilrain was always there, eyes that saw through smoke, eyes that could read the ground. Chamberlain said suddenly, Buster! Tell me something. What do you think of Negroes? Kilrain brooded. There are some who are unpopular, he concluded. Chamberlain waited. Well, if you mean the race, well, I don't really know. He hunched his shoulders. I have reservations, I will admit. As many a man does, as you well know. This is not a thing to be ashamed of. But the thing is, you cannot judge a race.
Any man who judges by the group is a peewit. You take men one at a time. And I've seen a few blacks that earned my respect. A few. Not many. But a few.
Chamberlain said. To me, there was never any difference.
None at all. None.
Of course, I didn't know that many. But those I knew... Well, you looked in the eye, and there was a man. There was the divine spark, as my mother used to say. That was all there was to it. All there is to it. We used to have visitors from the South before the war. It was always very polite. I never understood them. But we stayed off the question of slavery until near the end, out of courtesy. But toward the end, there was no staying away from it. And there was one time I'll never forget. There was this minister, a Southern Baptist, and this professor from the University of Virginia. The professor was a famous man, but more than that, he was a good man, and he had a brain. Rare combination.
True.
Well, we sat drinking tea. Ladies were present. I'll never forget. He held the tea like this. Chamberlain extended a delicate finger. I kept trying to be courteous, but this minister was so damned wrong and moral and arrogant all at the same time that he began to get under my skin. And finally he said, like this, "Look here, my good man, you don't understand." There was this tone of voice as if he was speaking to a stupid, dull child. And he was being patient, but running out of patience. Then he said, "You don't understand. You have to live with the Negro to understand. Let me put it this way. Suppose I kept a fine stallion in one of my fields, and suddenly one of your northern abolitionists came up and insisted I should free it. Well, sir, I would not be more astonished. I feel exactly that way about my blacks. And I resent your lack of knowledge, sir."
Kilrain grunted.
Chamberlain said, "I remember him sitting there, sipping tea. I tried to point out that a man is not a horse, and he replied very patiently that that was the thing I did not understand. That a Negro was not a man."
Then I left the room.
Kilrain smiled. Chamberlain said slowly, "I don't really understand it. Never have. The more I think on it, the more it horrifies me.
How can they look in the eyes of a man and make a slave of him, and then quote the Bible?"
But then, right after that, after I left the room, the other one came to see me, the professor. I could see he was concerned, and I respected him. And he apologized for having offended me in my own home.
"Oh, yes," Kilrain nodded. "He would definitely do that."
But then he pointed out that he could not apologize for his views, because they were honestly held. And I had to see he was right there. Then he talked to me for a while, and he was trying to get through to me, just as I had tried with the minister. The difference was that this was a brilliant man. He explained that the minister was a moral man, kind to his children, and that the minister believed every word he said, just as I did. And then he said, "My young friend, what if it is you who are wrong?" I had one of those moments when you feel that if the rest of the world is right, then you yourself have gone mad. Because I was really thinking of killing him, wiping him off the earth. And it was then I realized for the first time that if it was necessary to kill them, then I would kill them. And something at the time said, you cannot be utterly right. And there is still something every now and then which says, yes, but what if you are wrong?
Chamberlain stopped.
A shell burst dimly a long way off, a dull and distant thumping. They sat for a long while in silence. And Kilrain said softly, smiling,
"Colonel, you're a lovely man."
He shook his head.
"I see at last a great difference between us. And yet I admire you, lad. You're an idealist. Praise be."
Kilrain rubbed his nose, brooding. Then he said,
"The truth is, Colonel, that there's no divine spark, bless you. There's many a man alive no more value than a dead dog. Believe me, when you've seen them hang each other. Equality? Christ in heaven! What I'm fighting for is the right to prove I'm a better man than many. Where have you seen this divine spark in operation, Colonel? Where have you noted this magnificent equality? The great white joker in the sky dooms us all to stupidity or poverty from birth. No two things on earth are equal or have an equal chance, not a leaf nor a tree. There's many a man worse than me, and some better. But I don't think race or country matters a damn. What matters is justice. 'Tis why I'm here. I'll be treated as I deserve, not as my father deserved. I'm Kilrain, and I goddamn all gentlemen. I don't know who me father was, and I don't give a damn. There's only one aristocracy, and that's right here."
He tapped his white skull with a thick finger.
"And you, Colonel Laddie, are a member of it, and don't even know it. You are damned good at everything I've seen you do. A lovely soldier. An honest man. And you got a good heart on you, too. Which is rare in clever men. Strange thing, I'm not a clever man myself. But I know it when I run across it. The strange and marvelous thing about you, Colonel darling, is that you believe in mankind. Even preachers. Whereas when you've got my great experience of the world, you will have learned that good men are rare, much rarer than you think. Ah,"
he raised his hand, smiling, "don't you worry about ministers. The more you kill, the more you do the world a service." He chuckled, rubbing his face. His nose was fat and soft, rippling under his fingers. Chamberlain said, "What has been done to the black is a terrible thing."
"True, from any point of view. But your freed black will turn out no better than many the white that's fighting to free him. The point is that we have a country here where the past cannot keep a good man in chains, and that's the nature of the war. It's the aristocracy I'm after. All that lovely, plumed, stinking chivalry. The people who look at you like a piece of filth. A cockroach. Ah!"
His face twitched to stark bitterness.
"I tell you, Colonel, we got to win this war."
He brooded.
"What will happen, do you think, if we lose? Do you think the country will ever get back together again?"
"Doubt it. Wound is too deep. The difference is, if they win, there'll be two countries, like France and Germany and Europe, and the border will be armed. Then there'll be a third country in the West, and that one will be the balance of power." Kilrain sat moodily munching on a blade of grass. More cannon thumped. The dull sound rolled among the hills. Kilrain said, "They used to have signs on tavern doors. Dogs and Irishmen keep out. You ever seen them signs, Colonel?" Chamberlain nodded. "They burned the Catholic Church up your way not long ago. With some nuns in it."
"Yes." "There was a divine spark."
Chamberlain grinned, shook his head. Kilrain turned away. Chamberlain sat for a while silently, and then took out a copy of Harper's Weekly he'd carried up with him and began to look through it. There was an article by a general from Argentina concerning the use of Negro troops. He said that they fought very well. With training. Chamberlain's nose wrinkled. The world around him grew silent. There was something in the air. The odor of dead meat came down on the wind, drifting through the trees. Soft and sour. The smell of distant death. It passed like an invisible cloud. Kilrain said,
"Make you a little wager, Colonel. We'll sit here all day, and in the evening we'll march away again."
He lay back.
"So I might as well get some rest."
Chamberlain moved back against a tree. He was not tired. He closed his eyes, saw a sudden shocking memory of death. Torn flaps of skin. The black rotted meat of muscle. Kilrain said sleepily, "I bet nothing happens today." But Chamberlain knew. He was certain. He looked toward the odor of death. Still early in the day. Long time until nightfall. They'll come. He could not relax. "But what if it is you who are wrong?" "But I am not wrong. Thank God for that. If I were an officer for them, on the other side, what would I be feeling now?" The cannon had stilled. The old soldier was popping corn. Pop, pop, poppity pop. Chamberlain put down the paper, folded his arms, waited. 3. Longstreet. They had taken a door from its hinges at the Thompson house and placed it across fence rails to serve as a map table. Lee stood above it with his arms folded behind him, staring down. Although the morning was warm and humid, his coat was buttoned at the throat, his face pale. He put one hand down, drummed on the map, shook his head, then turned abruptly and walked off to the edge of the trees to look toward Cemetery Hill. Longstreet sat gazing at the map, fixing it in his mind. Johnston and Clark had scouted the Union position, and it was drawn now on the map in blue ink. Longstreet looked down at the map and then up at the hazy blue ridge in the east, trying to orient himself. There were two hills beyond Gettysburg. First Cemetery Hill, and beyond that, Culp's Hill. The Union Army had dug in along the crest of both hills in a crescent. From the two hills ran a long ridge like the shaft of a fishhook, Cemetery Ridge, sloping gradually down to the south to two more hills, one rocky and bare, the other high and thickly wooded. Meade had put troops along the ridge so that his position was shaped like the fishhook, but there were no troops yet on the rocky hill. Longstreet sat alone, a forbidding figure. He was thinking, "Lee has made up his mind. There's nothing he can do. Well, then there will be a scrap." He took a deep breath. "Ought to get something to eat." "General?" He looked down, saw the handsome face of Taylor, Lee's aide. "General Lee wishes to speak to you, sir." Lee was up on the rise by the seminary, walking back and forth under the shade trees. Officers sat quietly by, joking softly, respectfully with each other, keeping an eye on the old man walking back and forth, stopping to stare at the eastern hills, the eastern haze. Longstreet came up.
"General," Lee said.
Longstreet grunted. There was bright heat in Lee's eyes, like fever. Longstreet felt a shudder of alarm. Lee said,
"I like to go into battle with the agreement of my commanders as far as possible, as you know. We're all members of this army, in a common cause."
Longstreet waited.
"I understand your position," Lee said. "I did not want this fight, but I think it was forced upon us. As the war was,"
he added, "as the war was." He stopped and frowned, put up his fingers and rubbed the bridge of his nose. "Well," he said. He gestured toward the north.